we use sexuality to cope with our mortality, especially if our mortality is impending. In other words, we've been given only a certain amount of time left. We see oftentimes people who are dying in some way become more sexual and try to have more sexual experiences, because sex is the antithesis to death. Sex represents at its core, from an evolutionary perspective, life, right? It's reproduction. It's the creation of new life. And I think psychologically that affects us. And, you know, when people choose to cope with existential crises or death through sex and sexuality, I don't think it's necessarily maladaptive, as long as they're clear what their intentions are with the partners that they have. It's, you know, it's a way to cope with the fear of the unknown, the fear of an end, and so forth. And sex is exactly the opposite of that. But the slide in that pussy is a homicide. Sliding up pussy, it's a homicide. It's a homicide.
Welcome to Hookup Horror Stories, the podcast where we spill the tea on sex and dating. I'm Demi Weil, your resident sexual deviant. And today, my extra special guest deviant is executive director of the Erotic Heritage Museum in Las Vegas, Nevada, sexuality scholar and host of the Sex Nerd podcast, Dr. Victoria Hartman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I was just in Vegas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I was there for a podcast conference at the time of this recording. It was like last week.
Okay.
And I actually went to the Erotic Heritage Museum.
Yay, thank you.
I had no idea that you ran it.
Oh, yeah. I got there in 2009, actually, as a student, and did an internship there and ended up being the academic coordinator, and then left in 12 after I graduated. And then the owner of the museum — it's a for-profit museum, it's not a nonprofit.
Right.
The owner of the museum, I had gone to work for him. He owns the chain of Deja Vu clubs, boutiques, etc. That's him.
Okay, yeah.
And I had gone to work for him running the male review at the Hustler clubs. It was a Hustler male review called the Kings of Hustler. And I'm not a club person, and I think he could tell that. And so when management changed at the museum in 14, he invited me to his office and said, "What do you think we should do at the museum?" And I was so busy. I'm like, "I don't know. You have me working like 50, 60 hours a week. I have no time. You figure it out." And luckily we have that kind of a relationship that I can talk to him like that. And he takes it in stride. But then about 2 days later, I got a call from the corporate office, and they were like, "He wants to go pick up your keys." And I went, "Yep, okay, there I go. I'm the director now, and I have been ever since." So that was in 14. So I'm going on 10 years now.
That is fantastic. And congrats. I really enjoyed myself. I was there with my friend Jamal.
Thanks.
And I really enjoyed myself. I think I contacted you Thursday.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I realized you had a podcast and you were in Las Vegas, and I was like, "Hey, why don't I swing by?" You had a technical issue.
Yeah, you'll still have one.
We'll have one. So, but you kindly offered to guest on my show, so I was like, "Thank God!" And I'm happy I found you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm glad you came by. We're under, you know, we have a big 2-story exhibit that's under construction, so the museum's a little messy right now, but it's worth the mess. But we try to. You know, the museum in its prior life was really centered around the American Sexual Revolution. And that was fine for the folks at the time who were running it. And then when Harry and I decided to, or he invited me to run it kind of with him initially, and he's like, "What do you think we should do?" And I said, "You know, to me, being a scholar, in the way that I am," I said, "I would like to see like science and art mixed together
Yes.
You know, and he said, go for it. And so that's what the mission has been ever since, is this mixture of science and art, education, and people for, you know, the exterior looks really just neon-y and strip clubby and all that, you know, and then people come in
it
and they're like,
wow.
It
looks like a shithole from the outside, to be fair.
Yeah, it looks like a shitty strip club from the outside. And then, you know, and then they come in and people are really kind of nervous about coming in. They're like, oh, are we live sex shows here and stuff? And then they go through the museum and come out and they're like, we had no idea this was such a science and art-based educational facility. That we're almost 9 times out of 10, we get people saying, I'm impressed. We had one gal last week who was in and out in 5 minutes. She's like, I thought we were going to see like sex shows and weird vibrators and I want my money back. And I'm like, well, okay. You know, so I expected something else. I said, well, that's the problem with expectations, but you know what? I'll give you the refund because you were in and out in 5 minutes. But everyone else usually is like, there's so much here and you cover so many things. And I wish I could cover more. We just don't have enough space and we're 24,000 square feet. So...
And it's huge because I went to the Museum of Sex in New York. Mm-hmm. I will say that's a really cool one too, but it's like an immersive experience. The museum part of it is a very small, like single room.
Right.
And, but it's a very cool exhibit. People should see that. But you're like the Heritage Museum. Yeah. Holy crap. There's so much stuff in there.
Well, you know, each city has its own kind of flavor, and the New York Museum, we've heard that before. And the New York Museum, I think, is tailoring itself to folks who come to New York and have certain expectations of what you do in New York. We are straight up Vegas, baby. Mm-hmm. We're a Vegas museum, and that's how we've, you know, formulated how we present things. So,
yeah. I really appreciate it. And there was a lot in there. If you guys are ever in Vegas, it's a huge find. Definitely go visit.
Yay, come visit.
So where are you from?
Well, so I was originally born in Maine. My father was in the military. My mother was a German immigrant. And they didn't meet actually in the military, or as you know, my father being in the military, they met through the airline industry. My mother was a stewardess with Pan Am. And they met and had this whirlwind 3-month relationship. And oh, I was there. I was coming along, you know?
Yeah.
So I grew up splitting my time between Maine and Germany. You know, we were sort of this international family. and then my parents divorced when I was, well, they separated when I was like 9 or 10. And then my mother and I moved to Germany full time. So I'd have to say the biggest influence for me was German culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came into my teen years during the sort of tail end of the denazification effort in Germany. And German youth were very politically involved. Almost from the get-go, simply because of the denazification efforts, it would, you know, war and politics were always around us. It was integral in our education. And I really feel like people, they talk about, well, you shouldn't expose children to this and that and what have you, and the horrors of you know, conflict and all that. Personally, I feel as though I benefited from, you know, our field trips weren't to sort of the, you know, bread factory. Our field trips were to the camps.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't feel damaged by that. Quite honestly, I feel the opposite, that, you know, that how it affected me is I feel as though it's important to preserve history so we don't forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And I gladly take on the responsibility of making sure what happened in my country, in Germany, never happens again, as best as I can. And how I've chosen to do that is to preserve history. I can't really say why sexual history is something that I focused on, but, you know, given the sexual morals and ethics in Germany around sexuality being just a natural part of being human, it just all sort of coalesced. And I decided I wanted to go into sex education and also the preservation of sex history. And that's where I ended up.
That's a really cool kind of track, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, like Germany to this day, I mean, I have people, I have friends that have been to Germany. They're like, it's weird. Like, it's sexually weird.
Yeah, we don't have really too many taboos over there.
Yeah. So I guess exposure is just kind of like how you kind of gain your, anybody gains that. I mean, education is empowering, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. Like, the more you know, the less likely you are to engage in bad behavior.
Right, risky behavior. And, you know, we see that in study after study after study. When you look at, you know, sex education in European countries, the age in which people first have intercourse is later. They have a lower rate of STI transmission, a lower rate of teen pregnancy. I mean, to me, it seems pretty common sense that if you have a solid age-appropriate sex education program in school, that young people are going to be able to make better decisions for themselves. And parents, and I'm a parent, I have grandchildren, actually. And I always taught my kid, I always tried to be as appropriate, obviously, but as open to them and what the questions they had, rather than go, oh, we don't talk about that, or you're not old enough yet, or what have you. Like, I was like, look, here it is. And there's no big deal. It's just not that big of a deal. And you know, now I have grandsons who are in their preteens, and my daughter's actually bringing one of my grandsons out for a week in October. And he's at that age now where he might start asking questions. And my daughter's actually pretty great about, this is who Oma is, so just get ready.
you are the mom from Sex Education.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Gillian Anderson's character.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, that's super cool. So I have a little icebreaker to ask you first here.
Go for it.
What's you're a sex scholar. Yep. You've seen a lot. What's the weirdest porn you've ever seen?
The weirdest porn. Considering what my area of focus is, I've seen some really weird porn. I would have to say the weirdest, I don't know if I want to call it, the most unusual for me was a video of a feast. It was a video of a feast. So you had this big dining room table where people were sitting around it, and several naked women who you didn't see the before where they were getting enemas. You didn't see the after when they were replacing what had been washed out with one of the courses of the meal. What you did see, however, is the individual women going around to each person at the table, expelling parts of that course into the mouths of the attendants, you know, the attendees of the feast. And that went on for like 7 or 8 courses. I just went like, huh, okay. knowing how enemas work, you know, there comes a point where you really can't hold it anymore. So I was, first of all, amazed at the strength of the sphincters involved, that these courses could be doled out so eloquently. But it was just different. I'd seen food porn and stuff before, but not anything like this in particular. And you know, where I went to school, we had access to a lot of very interesting materials, wow. Self-control. Like, some people have amazing self-control. And I went like, well, I, you know, yeah. I hope no one got like, you know, E. coli or anything after that, but hey, there's a fetish for everything.
My God, I am speechless. Thank you for that.
I haven't seen anything to date, especially considering what I study, where I was like, oh my God, right? Although there was one, and my gay studies teacher, he still teases me about it to this day. There was one video that we had when we were doing our gay studies class, and he he was talking about gay sexuality on film and in the different ways that it was depicted. And there was one, it was called, I don't know what actually what it was called, but it was a Cum Guzzlers video.
Okay.
And
unfamiliar.
Okay. And I had like the nerves of steel. Like everybody was like, oh, Victoria has nerves of steel, you know, what have you. And I was surprised to find not the cum guzzling itself, but apparently, like I had a really good friend, a gay man, who we just kind of stuck together when we were in school. And he was commenting on the different substances that the individual men had ingested and why their cum looked a certain way, depending on whether they had, you know, used some kind of like drug or alcohol or what have you. And some cum was like chunky and green, and some were all kinds of different colors and consistencies. And he was sort of humorously breaking them down for me. And I don't know why, but after about 5 minutes of that, I went, I need to go. And so, I like, and one of the other students, Mercedes, she was like, oh, honey, you are turning various shades of green. And I'm like, and I ran out of there and made it to the bathroom and came back. And my teacher to this day, and he goes, I'm the one who got you. I'm like, you sure did. You did. I don't know why I reacted that. It had nothing to do with the behavior. It was the consistency of the different ejaculate and the way my friend was sort of describing them that I was like, nope, there's my stomach. It's coming up. I got to go.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. A feast out of butts was no big deal, but you know, that's the one who got me. And I have no idea to this day why. Just don't know.
Well, there's only so much. There's only so much a person can take.
Well, now it's just funny. You know, when
people there's only so much cum a person can guzzle.
Exactly. You know, I was like, well, I thought I was a whore, but I don't. I think I've been to a whole other level, and I don't think I've gotten there yet. So.
Oh my god. Okay, I think it's a perfect time to take a break. We'll be right back. And we're back. That story was, oh, Lord, there's only so much, you know, it brings to mind this meme that I saw recently. And I think it said something along the lines of like, it was a picture of like an old person, like just with a very dismayed look on their face. And it said, this is the ancestors looking at you eating ass when they died of like cholera back in the day. Right.
Yeah. I've seen similar where like, you know, something along the lines of, you know, here's a picture of your grandpa from 1940 and here's your picture of your grandpa from 2050 and you know, the different things that they did. I'm not summarizing it very well, but yeah, there's a lot more openness these days for sure.
Definitely. Speaking of openness, another exhibit that I saw when I was in Vegas was the Bodies Museum. And I was very surprised when I was listening to one of these podcasts that you, number one, yours, and then another one you were on, and you were particularly open about cannibalism and necrophilia. Why is it that sex and death are so intertwined?
That's a really good question. You know, I centered my academic studies around necrophilia. Originally, the purpose was I wanted to help reduce the incidences of sexual murder, right? And I thought to myself, well, if I can find these folks before they offend, perhaps I could save a life or two. So it was an altruistic drive that originally got me into that. I wanted to go after who I considered the worst of the worst to see if maybe I could help prevent crime and suffering and these kinds of things. And I have a really good friend who says, you know, the great thing about science is you're usually wrong. And yeah. I was wrong. You know, what I did is I found individuals online for whom it was a kink. Mm-hmm. And did a couple of studies around that. And I still write academic papers. I wrote a book about, you know, this kind of stuff. And there was definitely a divide between fetishists and, say, someone like Ted Bundy or BTK or what have you. There was a noticeable divide. And my studies took me into the kink realm, where these kinds of expressions are sometimes manifested in the BDSM world. And almost everyone that I interviewed, they were very big on real death was completely repulsive to them. They wanted consenting partners and so forth. Those online communities were kinksters who felt a lot of shame around having this particular kink. And some of them described when they became aware of it and so forth. So that was my, I kind of focused more in that realm. And some of the feedback, I've just only recently sort of moved into the serial killer realm as a field of study. And the themes that seem to keep popping up are expressions of extreme levels of submission. In other words, being able to give oneself completely over to a partner as an expression of love or affection or what have you. Yeah. And that sometimes is represented as a quote unquote death or dying for them or so forth, at least in the kink sense. Right.
Right.
And then on the dominant side, it was wanting someone to either give themselves completely as an expression of love. So in other words, the dominant felt extreme levels of love by that expression, or they wanted an unresisting partner who they could do whatever they wanted to with, and that unresisting partner accepted them completely. So those were the things that I found in the kink world anyway. Now, if you read some of the material from, say, Erwin Yalom, who's a really one of my favorite counseling professionals and authors, he wrote a book, Staring Into the Sun, and he talks about how we use sexuality to cope with our mortality, especially if our mortality is impending. In other words, we've been given only a certain amount of time left. We see oftentimes people who are dying in some way become more sexual and try to have more sexual experiences, because sex is the antithesis to death. Sex right. represents at its core, from an evolutionary perspective, life. Right? It's reproduction. It's the creation of new life. And I think psychologically that affects us. And, you know, when people choose to cope with existential crises or death through sex and sexuality, I don't think it's necessarily maladaptive, as long as they're clear what their intentions are with the partners that they have. It's, you know, it's a way to cope with the fear of the unknown, the fear of an end and so forth. And sex is exactly the opposite of that. Now, in serial killers, it sort of gets warped in its how it's manifested, at least from what I'm gathering so far with the limited amount of materials that I've read up until this point. It's not necessarily a way to cope with death. It's a way to gain power over others and death, right? And there are other scholars out there that are way more proficient than I am in serial killer mentality, but that's kind of what I'm getting. It gets twisted in those, you know, in those minds, but when you're talking about people who are into kink and fetish or just coping with death through sex and sexuality, that's not all that unusual, actually.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, I am a gay man. I've always been very kind of fascinated with death. I mean, I love true crime. I love hanging out in cemeteries. I do yoga. Hollywood forever. You know, I love ghost stories. I love everything about death. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from like just
me. You need to come hang out at my house. I think you'd love it.
I would love it. Yes.
I have a whole like gallery. So. Yeah.
But I think there's something to be said about like just being a queer person, because like we're kind of always on the brink of death, you know, especially after the AIDS epidemic. You know, we became very acquainted with it. Mm-hmm. That's why I think queer people love horror movies. I think in some way that's also why women also are really drawn to serial killers. We did a whole episode on the Dahmer. Me and my friend Devannon did a whole episode on Dahmer here on the show. And so, and he was like, he was so hot. He was so fine. He was like, he killed people like you, you know, but at the same time, there was something very alluring about that. There is something very kind of like, you know, giving yourself away, like you said, like completely.
Yeah. Well, on testing, I would argue that a lot of risk-taking behavior, not even the kind that would be considered unhealthy, but things like skydiving is us testing our limits where death is concerned.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an unusual behavior, really.
I don't think so either. I think it's a very human behavior.
Yeah. 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 No. And yeah, I would agree with you, especially in, you know, when, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. I was a teenager coming of age during the AIDS epidemic. And I remember not only the death toll, but how invalidated the queer and gay community was by government officials. I as a 16-year-old, I remember I had a lot of gay friends, and, you know, don't kiss someone who's gay. Don't hug someone who's gay. Don't share a fork. You know, all these
families were afraid to hug their children. Yeah, right.
And gay men would die alone in hospitals because their, you know, families thought they were, you know, lepers and they were going to get infected. And it was just like, it was horrific.
Yeah.
So that totally makes sense to me that, you know, especially the gay community, who was the first impacted by the AIDS crisis, and also just recently by the monkeypox virus outbreak too.
I had it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there again, and as soon as that happened, the stigma came right back. And it's like, this is not how we're going to deal with these things, period. They're just why, and well, you know, the environment, the political environment in this country anyway, around queer people and the LGBT community, reproductive rights, et cetera, is just a shit show right now. So we're all kind of dealing with, those of us who are in the queer, I'm a bisexual woman, like we're all dealing with this, I don't even know what to call it, this nuclear war against orientation and reproduction, if it's outside of the cis hetero male, you know, ideology. I don't even know what to call it anymore.
So. I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you exactly what it is. And it is a rubber band effect. It's basically, we've come so far. We've done so much. Mm-hmm. However, in all that progress that we've made, we've gotten a little on our high horse, and it's made us less approachable. And so the people who were, you know, already afraid of us to begin with, They have retreated even farther.
Right.
And now us liberals and the conservatives, we're just sticking our heads in the sand. We're not trying to like make this work. We're literally trying to like just avoid and deflect, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's frustrating.
Yeah.
But it's just the climate that we're in right now. And it's our own making.
It is, you know, and for me, I mean, even I get singled out, and I can pass as straight. Some of my favorite dating partners have been bi men, and they've often talked about the sort of silent stigma that they face. And I always found that to be rather unusual, because some of the best, you know, like especially intimate partners that I've had have been either open to exploring that or like were just as bi as I was. And there was this understanding that we had about each other, you know, where it wasn't like, oh, well, you haven't decided yet. It was no, even my mom until recently was less like, it's a phase. And I'm like, Mom, I'm 53. It's not a phase anymore. Okay. It's just not, you know. I was in private practice for a while after I got out of school. And consistently, no matter who my client was, as a talk therapist, the underlying expression of everyone is, I just want to be accepted for who I am. That was what it was at its core. All of the presenting issues that they would come in with at the very bottom of that well was, can I just be accepted for who I am? And the fact that we as a society, and I can't speak for other ones, I haven't been back in Germany for a long time, but that we as a society don't seem to understand that very fundamental thing blows my mind, because it's so obvious. Well,
they taught us that in kindergarten, the golden rule. Treat right. others the way you want to be treated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Hello.
And I sometimes wonder, and I don't want to, I'm not going to like, you know, lay my hat on it, but you know, to me it seems those who would attack others for certain things are simply avoiding turning the mirror back on themselves.
Right.
It's easier to deflect. And a friend of mine once said, she's like, if you spot it, you got it. Right. And to me, that was in its own simple way, very prophetic, because if you are going after someone for their sexual orientation or the way that they express themselves or what have you, where sexuality is concerned, I'm more interested in you and why you're fixated on that than the person who's just living their life over there. You know what I mean? I try to do this work through the museum as best as I can to keep educating people.
Yeah. I think the best antidote to all of that is just ask why. Mm-hmm. And it's really, honestly, when people come at me like on the internet, and which happens quite a bit lately, quite a bit. My last YouTube video was like really transphobic in the comment section. So I was
great.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But I was just asking people, why? Why do you feel that way? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with this? Mm-hmm. And honestly, I was getting responses. I was getting honest responses, and, you know, I was getting interaction with people. And so, they take with it what they will, you know, a lot, of, you know, most of them are not going to listen, sure. But you have to kind of meet people where they are a little bit, you know, it has to come on both sides, of course, in order to meet in the middle, but you have to meet people where they are. You have mm-hmm. to understand where they come from.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
I agree with you.
There's this whole dialogue about it on Twitter. A friend of mine also got a little bit of in trouble with liberals because of he went on to talk about trans issues. And I feel like I have not heard a lot of like trans people on news segments, which is a whole other thing.
Right.
But
they haven't been. It's like maybe you should have the voices of the people who
affected. Yeah.
Are affected. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, there's a whole, we veered very into a political place over here.
Sure.
I'm not afraid of having difficult conversations with people.
That's good.
But yeah. Sometimes you just got to meet people where they are.
Yep. Exactly. And we've lost that ability. I'm not talking about, again, you know, with my upbringing in Germany, extremism can come from any side, and we need to come back from that brink and start talking again. Mm-hmm. We might have different ideological perspectives, and some of them are really, really difficult, especially like around reproduction and so forth. But when you start denying people body autonomy because of your ideology, I don't care what side you're on. Nothing good can come of that.
Right.
And I say that as a teenager growing up in Germany post-World War II.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about some lighter topics.
You got it.
And we're back. I'm here with Dr. Victoria Hartman from the Erotic Heritage Museum. And I know it's story time.
It's story time? Okay.
Story time.
Well, story time. So, you know, I got to thinking about it. I was spending all week kind of thinking about that. And maybe I approach my own sexual experiences from a little bit of a different perspective. I tend to go into situations curious, like, because I don't know what to expect. I don't know. When I decide I'm going to be intimate with someone, I base always on chemistry. You know, I'm a bisexual woman, and if there's chemistry, that's the first driver, is chemistry. And I'm also quite visual. So, you know, there's those two components. But beyond that, I don't have expectations because I don't know that person. And so I go into it with a sense of curiosity. Like, I'm going to, and the thing is a lot of people don't think of it this way, especially since hookup culture has become rather, I don't know, mainstreamed, I guess would be the word to use.
Yeah.
But I go into it with, where's this experience going to take me? And I'm just going to run with it. So
that's a very healthy mindset, I'd say.
Yeah. And I can't really say, I'd have to say, you know, and full disclosure, I've been around the block probably 7,500 times, but that, not an actual number, but you know, I've embraced these experiences as they've come my way, or initiated them if someone seemed interested or what have you. And so some of them have been, actually a majority of them have been incredibly satisfying. I don't necessarily go back for seconds, but you know, when I was in the moment, they were satisfying. And I'd say probably 95 to 98% of the time, I've been quite lucky, really. But I also am rather assertive in those situations where I know what my body needs and I know how to ask for it in a way that is comfortable for people and that kind of thing. And if
well
they
versed
say,
in it.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily do, you know, check in, but I always make sure consent is ongoing, you know. And I would have to say, maybe out of everyone, there's maybe been two or three experiences that I would have to say rate high on my frustration level.
Yeah.
One in particular, though, that really stood out, where I just was frustrated to the point where I thought, you know, I don't know that I really want to make any kind of an investment here going forward. Because most people stay friends with me, or, you know, whatever. It was many, many years ago, and I matched with this gal on Tinder or whatever it was, and we met up, and I thought, well, maybe a neutral environment, you know, I'll get a hotel room. We have several here in Vegas. And we met up for coffee at the hotel, and the conversation seemed to go quite well. The in-person spark wasn't as much as I had hoped it would be, but there was still enough, right? And so, I don't know, it was about an hour and a half after we had coffee. I said, well, you know, how are you feeling? Would you, you know, are you interested in joining me in the hotel room? And she was like, yeah. And I said, okay. So we went upstairs, and I kept trying to gauge where she was at. And we ended up having this 2.5 hour conversation where I kept flirting and making innuendo, and there was just nothing coming back at me. And I went like, okay, well, maybe this evening is just going to be a nice conversation. And then it was getting later, and she just kind of popped off with, so are we going to do this or what? And I got like zero signals from her that she was interested in taking it that direction. And then the bed was literally right next to us. And I went like, yeah, well, I wasn't really sure where you were at, and I didn't want to, you know, push the issue. And she was just like, no, let's do this, because I got to work in the morning. And I went, okay. So then we climbed into bed and then, you know, started making out and all of that, you know, as things are getting hot and heavy. And I'm like, okay, there's this flow going, you know, what have you. And, you know, I ended up, after we were making out and doing all kinds of stuff and whatever, I ended up going down on her for about 45 minutes. I happened to be, whatever set of genitals are in front of me, I'm very much the connoisseur. I'm like, just in my, here, right here. So, and I, you know, I really enjoyed myself, and she seemed to. And so I sort of, after that, slithered back up and we started making out again. And I try not to go into these experiences with expectations, but I think reciprocation isn't an unreasonable expectation. Right. I don't think it's unreasonable. And she had she was very clear that she was a lesbian. This wasn't another bisexual woman. She was very, very clear that she was a lesbian. And I said, okay. And, but she was fine with the fact that I was bi. And so we made out for about maybe another 10 minutes or so. And then she sort of slithered one of her legs between mine and kind of moved it back and forth a little bit. And for about 5 minutes or so, maybe. And I'm like, oh, this is different. Oh, sure, I'll go with this. And, you know, maybe she's just kind of warming up herself again, you know. And then she sort of, her leg stopped. Now, mind you, it was like between my legs, kind of touching my vulva, right?
Right.
And she sort of stops. And then she says, are you done? And I'm like, I'm sorry. And she's like, you know, I'm getting tired and I really have to go to work in the morning and I really want to get enough sleep. So are you good? You're taken care of. And I'm like, at that point it was such a weird evening and I got so many mixed signals that I was like, you know what? I'm good. Let me walk you down to the lobby. She got dressed. I walked her down to the lobby. She left. I went back and I just decided to stay in the hotel. And I just was like, I don't even know what to make of that. For the next week, I got bombarded with text messages from this gal about how great things were. And here's a picture of her breakfast. And here's, she hates her boss. And here she's at work going into the bathroom. And this is a picture of her brother. I was getting 20 to 30 text messages a day. With random stuff. And I'm like, I was trying to be nice and just, you know, I responded every so often, but I am a very busy career woman, right? I don't have the time to have ongoing text conversations all day long, right? I just don't. I need to focus on what I'm doing at work. And after about 5 days of that, she started getting upset and going, you know, you're not responding as much. And I said, I don't ghost people. I think everyone deserves respect. So I talked to her and I said, listen, first of all, like, I'm not sure, you know, we really clicked in the way that I was hoping. And also, I don't really think I can give you the kind of relationship that it seems like you're looking for. Like, I, you know, I'm just not that much of a communicator, like to the degree that you are. And maybe someone else is going to be more interested in that than I might be. I'm very career oriented and I just don't want you to be kind of hanging and stuff. So, you know, I'm really sorry, but I just don't think that we're, you know, clicking the way that maybe we could have.
Oh, she hated that.
Okay. Well, cause I didn't want to be mean. There's no reason to be, right? Like, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe we can go walk our dog sometime. And I said, well, you know, we'll see. And it was, I actually got
not what I said.
Yeah, right. You know, and so I got bombarded a few more days with random text messages and, you know, she didn't really like get upset or anything. It was just like, gosh, I'm so sorry I misread it. And, you know, and I was like, you know, hey, it's cool, whatever. It's just, sometimes things just don't click, you know, it's cool. But, I left that experience just frustrated and didn't really know where to take it or how to communicate because her communication was so like, I'm feeling really put out by you kind of vibe. Right. And I'm just like, well, then why am I here? You know, I'm going to go to sleep. So I'd have to say that would be probably the most frustrating experience that I've had in all my years of, you know, intimately connecting with people. And I really am not interested in repeating that one. So, you know, but it was a learning experience and I hope that, you know, I ended things as respectfully as she deserved. Because I'm really big on that. I'm not a big fan of the ghosting thing or whatever, you know, just because you don't click or even because you didn't necessarily have a great experience doesn't mean you have to be a douche, you know? So I just was like, hey, I'm just not feeling it.
Just not I agree. Feeling it. Yeah. I I have a very similar, I think we almost had the same experience.
Oh, okay. Tell.
there was this very attractive guy that I slept with a couple of times. But I don't even know why it was like a repeat thing because the first time was bad. he was very good looking. So
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I, Yeah, a huge dig, nice ass, just like everything.
Sometimes you just go back and go, did it really not work? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. You really are trying to make it work.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the second time was even worse than the first time because, like, neither of us did anything. And then he just, you know, like, left. But then afterwards, he kept texting me and calling me and telling me all this good stuff that's happening to him. And he's got this new... his first time on camera, he's doing a TV show, like blah blah blah, this and that. I was like, yo, like I'm done. And he goes, why, what's up? I'm like, I just really didn't enjoy having sex with you, and I don't know what you're trying to get at right now, because it was just not working for me. He was so pissed because I'm sure no one has ever told him no before. So it was very that, and I was like, oh, okay. And then he like blocked me and like deleted my number and like just all this shit. So I was like, okay, bye. You know, like I was being honest with you and I wasn't trying, it was a text message. So it wasn't really like, you know, face to face, unfortunately. So people kind of read things the way that they, that they will.
Yep.
But yeah, it was the same kind of situation where like, you know, there was just something, communication was off, and
it was definitely a lesson, and I'm sure you probably agree it was a lesson in that, you know, people will read into situations what they are going to read into them from their own sort of viewpoint and you know the things that influence them, and sometimes they miss the mark. And well, that's happened. That happens. Yeah. You know, what are you gonna
do? Yeah. Especially when people are very selfish in bed.
Yeah. It was just, I mean, and I understand some people like pillow princesses. I am definitely not even remotely a pillow princess at all. Mm-mm. And I just, I love reciprocation. I love giving, I love receiving. And I'm not going to jive with someone who's only into receiving and not really into reciprocation. We're just not going to blend well. So, hey, you know, that's just the way it is.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Take
I wonder
that,
how common that story is, though, because you have a similar one. Like, is it common, really?
It's very common. Yeah. Huh.
Wow.
Especially in LA. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
See, everyone's... I don't date in Vegas, so I don't know.
Everyone's selfish out here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That sucks.
But sometimes
sex very fun, does it? Thing.
Sometimes it's a good thing, but you know,
right?
You live and you learn.
Yeah, sure.
Dr. Victoria Hartman, this has been amazing. Before I let you go, do you have time to play a quick game with me?
Okay. I think I
sprung this on you, but
you sprung it on me.
At the end of every episode, I like to play this like quick little game with people. It's called Red Flags. Do you know how to play Red Flags?
What?
Red Flags.
Okay.
Do you know how to play Red Flags?
Nope, no clue.
Okay, I'm going to give you a situation. All you got to do is tell me if it's a red flag for you or not.
Okay.
Okay. Number one, they can get you into literally anywhere, but they only speak in bad puns.
Red flag.
Big red flag.
Big red flag. Yeah, thanks. Next.
Number two, they own a time machine, but they are eligible for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Not a red flag.
Not a red flag. The time machine's kind of a big green flag. And even if afterwards, after they pass, they might bequeath you the time machine.
Hey, you know what? I like everybody. Bring it on. We can travel through time. Let's do that.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
They are a superhero, but they laugh incessantly during sex.
That is a green flag, because that just makes it hilarious. I'm down for that.
That's fun. They're a best-selling author, but they only talk through puppets.
I can fetishize anything. That's a green flag. Turn into a kink.
This is good. This is good. Last one. They are a mer person, but they only eat deep fried foods.
Can't do the deep fried foods. So I'd have to say that one's a red flag. Yeah.
Plus, if they're a mer person, like how do you know fish down there?
No. See, now I'd have to fried foods. I'd end up having to have like a coronary bypass. No, that's okay. I'll pass. I'm good.
We're good on that one.
That was fun. Oh my God.
Super fun.
Oh my God. That was great.
All right. Dr. Victoria Hartman, this has been fun. This has been so much
fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome back anytime. Okay. There's stuff we didn't even get to, which I need to have you back for. But again, this has been super cool.
We have a huge grand opening of the new exhibit that you might have seen being built on June 3rd. I can't say anything about the exhibit now, but I'm going to make an announcement on my podcast, but I'd love to send out an invite to you and whoever you're in LA, but specifically because it's LA, I think it's going to be really, this grand opening is going to be really appealing to a lot of people in the music industry in particular.
Ooh. Okay. Yes. This is going to be super fun.
It's a big deal. And we have like these big celebrity names that have already signed on to coming. And I'm like, oh, it's going to be the biggest thing that we've done. So
I'm there. I am there. I will make it happen.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, I will hear back from you very soon. Where can my listeners find you?
I do post sort of like Instagram shorts on my Facebook and on Instagram, which is Sex Nerd Pod. And my YouTube channel right now, because of some technical issues I'm having, I'm not able to put out my full length videos, but I still have a pretty sizable library there, and that's Sex Nerd Podcast on YouTube. So if they want to comb through, what I've already got there, and then I'll be adding some. Actually, one of the things that we were going to cover today, which was this on hebristophiles, which is, of course, women who fetishize serial killers. I'm going to do an episode on that one as soon as my equipment is back up and running. So if they want to find me there, I'll be there as soon as I get my equipment back.
Exactly. And we still need to talk about that. We only barely barely scratched the surface on that today. So
Next conversation, I'll do a serial killer talk.
Definitely. Again, you'll find all those links in the show notes here about down below. Dr. Victoria Hartman, this has been awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A very special thank you to my guests for joining me in this week's episode. Check out the episode description for all of their information. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a comment and a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It'll really help out the show. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel for video versions of this show and other content. You will find my blogs, The Deviant Diaries, and A Deviant's Guide to Sex, show notes, articles used, and Hookup Horror Stories official merch on my website at DimitriWild.com. You can also purchase both of my poetry books, Bitter Blue Pill, and Always Nothing in the Time of Champions, from Amazon.com. Just search for Dimitri Wild. Oh, one last thing. Thank you for listening. Stay deviant.
Remember, subscribing might not be worth it, but it's also not optional. So just do it.